Welcome to the Naval Academy Museum's Warrior Writers Podcast. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, and this 14-part series will take you decade by decade, starting with the 1870s, discussing the personalities, technologies, and events that helped shape today's U.S. Navy. This podcast coincides with the Naval Academy Museum's exhibit, Warrior Writers, the U.S. Naval Institute, open from September 10th, 2015, through January 31st, 2016. Our guest for each episode leading us through the decades will be first Naval Academy History Professor Emeritus and noted historian Craig Simons, who is awarded the Samuel Eliot Morison Prize for his novel Neptune, The Allied Invasion of Europe and the D-Day Landing, and is also author of the upcoming book, A Concise History of the U.S. Navy. Craig will be followed by the director of the Naval Academy Museum, Claude Barrabe. Craig, we find ourselves in the 1960s, and the decade began with the election of John Kennedy, and the dominant foreign policy event of his tenure was the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. What role did the Navy play in the Cuban Missile Crisis, and what does this event tell us about the role of the Navy in the 1960s?
Well, it's interesting, Sal. You know, the Cuban Missile Crisis has become almost the school solution for crisis management. I know it's taught in a lot of business schools. I know it's taught at the Naval War College and elsewhere, I'm sure, as kind of the way to get things done. And the reason that's the case is because it demonstrated patience on the part of the responding power, that is the United States, the formulation of the XCOM, the Executive Committee that deliberated over how to do this. It demonstrated flexibility, that is to say that there were a variety of options, and of course there was a satisfactory outcome. The United States achieved its objective without anybody dying. And I think one of the reasons it's become so popular as a case study is because so often we look at foreign policy problems, or problems of any kind for that matter, as almost a binary circumstance, that we have to choose option A or option B, that in the case of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, when the Soviets placed intermediate-range ballistic missiles in Cuba, and we found out about it on our own because of the surveillance conducted by the U-2 planes and the photographs that they took, it seemed that we had only two options. We either had to negotiate, gee, what will we do? We've discovered this. What do you want? How can we respond? Or we had to attack violently and get rid of those missiles. And I think what's useful in terms of the Navy's history is to remember that instead of accepting one or the other of those apparently binary options, the possession of naval superiority gave us third options, maybe even fourth and fifth options. The decision that was finally come up with by the Executive Committee to enact what for all practical purposes was a blockade, but which was called a quarantine to avoid international law complications, demonstrated determination on the part of the United States, demonstrated that we were not going to allow the Soviet Union to present us with a fait accompli. We caught them red-handed. We were responding in a thoughtful, deliberative, and so far not violent way. And that third way was only possible because the United States had naval superiority. So I think the fact that the Navy provides a nation with various alternatives beyond, oh, we must surrender or we must attack, is one of the crucial features to naval power in the sort of twilight world of the Cold War that 1962 represented. Now, there were limits. There were limits to this. The problem that President Kennedy confronted in accepting a quarantine as opposed to either abject surrender or violent response was that while a blockade can prevent more missiles from coming in, it cannot remove the missiles that are already there. But what happened is that by demonstrating that stalwart nonviolent stance, it gave us an edge in the essentially diplomatic confrontation that ensued. So there was a negotiated solution, but not a negotiated solution from weakness. It gave us leverage in the subsequent discussions. And I think the key lesson for the Navy in the 1960s and maybe in the 20-teens as well is that the world is not binary, and surrender and war are not the only options. But naval power gives you a variety of ways that you can respond to a crisis, the ability to enforce a quarantine and to make it stand and to achieve your objective in an environment where nobody has to die to make that happen. And I think that's why the Cuban Missile Crisis is still studied today as a classic example of crisis management. And I think it says a lot about the role of the Navy in the 1960s and in the subsequent decades as well.
As the Cuban Missile Crisis dominated the first part of the decade, we also saw the beginnings of the American involvement in the Vietnam War that came to dominate the end of the decade. How was the Navy an integral part to the origins of our involvement in this war?
Well, that, of course, is enormously controversial. The United States had been providing aid in the form of economic support and advice to its military officers to South Vietnam in its civil war with North Vietnam. But what brought the United States into the war as a full-time participant was the so-called Gulf of Tonkin incident, which led to the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which authorized the use of American ground troops and led to the lengthy American involvement in the war. And because of that, there's a tendency to point to the Gulf of Tonkin and what happened there as the trigger for American involvement. And that's both true and not, in a way. It became controversial not only because of what it led to, but also because of what may or may not have happened in the Gulf of Tonkin. A certain amount of that is well known, that two American destroyers were providing distant support for South Vietnamese PT boats that were attacking North Vietnamese positions. And the North Vietnamese themselves came out in their own PT boats and attacked the two American destroyers off the coast. Then supposedly 2 days later, there was a second attack. And that there's a lot of controversy about whether that happened, when it happened, how serious it was, and so on. In a way, that's less crucial than the simple recognition that the political environment in which those things took place put the onus of decision-making on the American administration to decide what to do about that. It was an election year. In 1964, this is August of 1964, so it's nearing election day. The American president, Lyndon Johnson, was running against a hawkish challenger from the Republican Party, Barry Goldwater, and needed to look sufficiently hawkish himself. And as a result, used, I think, the incidents in the Tonkin Gulf to justify his request for additional authority from the Congress to use military force, and a very vaguely worded authorization that probably was irresponsible on the part of the Congress not to put any kind of limits on that, simply allowed him to use whatever force he deemed necessary to protect the security and interests of the United States. It's a pretty open-ended resolution. But the political environment in which that took place was the key element there. A fake attack would have been enough if politics demanded it, and a real attack would not have been enough for an administration that was determined to avoid war. I think one of the things, if I can combine what we talked about in terms of the Cuban Missile Crisis just 2 years before, that the possession of a Navy provided a variety of options. And in this particular case, the administration seized upon a military option because of the circumstances in the Gulf of Tonkin. I think that scholars are going to debate that second attack forever and a day. But a lot of that is kind of useless argumentation, because I think the Lyndon Johnson administration was determined to demonstrate its toughness against communism in North Vietnam, and therefore seized that moment to make that point. And he could have, as his predecessor did, I think, found a middle ground in using military forces generally and naval forces in particular to perhaps find a different way to approach that particular problem.
And with the conflict fully underway in Vietnam, what were the different roles the Navy played there?
Well, there were a wide variety of this. I mean, this is a big question because I think in any war fought thousands of miles away from the American homeland, one of the Navy's big jobs is always logistical. I mean, it's impossible to fight an overseas war when we're talking about World War One, World War Two, Korea, or Vietnam without the logistics support that only a sea force can provide. So I'm going to mention logistics first, even though that doesn't get the headlines in most of the accounts of the Navy's role in Vietnam. Then in addition to that, of course, there was coastal patrol. One of the ways the communists in South Vietnam were being supplied by their North Vietnamese partners was not only overland through the famous Ho Chi Minh Trail, but also by sea in a myriad of junks and occasional large transports, bringing supplies down along the coast. And it was the Navy's job to interfere with that. And that's a difficult job because you don't want to inhibit legitimate coastal trade. And one sampan or junk looks pretty much like another. So here the Navy has this difficult job of stopping and searching and vetting. And it's a very frustrating and difficult job. And if you want to argue that supplies got through anyway, yes, they did. As they did, for example, in the Civil War when we tried to blockade the Confederacy, but a lot of material was intercepted as well. That was had the overall name of Operation Market Time, and the long-suffering sailors who worked in that operation had a tough job, as did the sailors who participated in Operation Game Ward, which was the effort to patrol the various outlets and canals of the Mekong River Delta. You know, the Mekong, one of the great rivers of the world, runs down and sort of branches out into a variety of channels before it runs into the South China Sea, as does, for example, the Mississippi River into the Gulf. And in between those various channels are canals and rivulets, many of which were navigable by small craft, and the Vietnamese communists were using that area as kind of a refuge. So in Operation Game Warden, the Navy had to go in and small craft and patrol these channels and attack enemy forces when necessary. And that was a difficult job, too. The one that I think got most of the headlines was the Navy's job of bombing from what was called Yankee Station, the carrier's station off of North Vietnam, Yankee Station on the north, Dixie Station in the south. The Yankee Station carriers flew sorties into North Vietnam to hit various targets. The pilots had difficulty because the rules of engagement often were relatively narrow, trying to avoid collateral damage, which would make a political solution more difficult. That made their job tougher. And, of course, every time a pilot was shot down and was captured, it gave the North Vietnamese more leverage in the subsequent negotiations that came about. So it was more dramatic. That is to say, the bombing missions from Yankee Station were more dramatic, but all and filled with genuine peril to the pilots, but also filled with diplomatic peril, if you would, because of the consequences that ensued. And we cannot leave discussion of the Navy's role in Vietnam without saying something about the United States Marine Corps. I mean, the Marines in I Corps had a very difficult job fighting not only in an environment reminiscent of a physical environment or reminiscent of Guadalcanal, but a political environment reminiscent of Korea. So combining the two difficulties of those battles in one is kind of the difficulty that the Marines had. And again, given the circumstances they faced, did a rather remarkable job.
And as always, our Navy reflects the nation it serves. And during the 60s, that was also the decade of the civil rights movement. How did that impact the Navy?
Well, it did obviously impact the Navy. You know, one of the generalizations I'd like to make about this is that the Vietnam War was very controversial at home. And so was the civil rights movement. There was a lot of anxiety, turmoil, protests, some occasionally violent, about both of those things. And what's curious about that is that there was a kind of a generalized conflation of those issues. I think as a rule, and there are exceptions to every rule, but as a rule, the older generation tended to support the war out of a habit of supporting America's foreign efforts, and to resist changes to the old relations between the races that had characterized the years where they had grown up. So older Americans tended to support the war and oppose civil rights. That's a horrible generalization, but I'm going to make it anyway. And younger Americans tended to be skeptical of the war and more supportive of the civil rights. And this created a kind of a generational confrontation. And as I say, this wasn't universal, but it was common. And what that meant was that each of those issues, those who supported the war were assumed to be skeptical of civil rights. Those who opposed the war were assumed to be supporters of civil rights. And there was some conflation there that was not always accurate, but the issues got curiously intertwined. And that was true within the Navy as well. I think, again, as a rule, senior chiefs, master chiefs within the Navy, as well as captains and admirals, all tended to be rather conservative. They wanted the Navy the way it had been when they came up through the ranks, so that dramatic social changes were difficult for them. They were, by instinct, patriotic and therefore supportive of the war. So there was almost a generational confrontation within the Navy as well. Junior officers, more supportive of civil rights, more skeptical of the war in Vietnam, and junior enlisted seemed to be on one side. Senior enlisted, the chiefs in particular, captains and admirals, seemed to be on the other side. So that was a kind of a curious confrontation. And then, of course, the civil rights movement impacted the Navy because the Navy, being a large bureaucratic organization, was resistant to change, not necessarily emotionally or ideologically, but simply because of the size of the institution and the traditions that had existed within it for decades, if not generations, so that the introduction of an increased number of African Americans or Hispanic, Latino Americans into the Navy's ranks, and their sensitivity about the fact that captain's mast, for example, tended to fall more heavily on sailors of color than white sailors. That was noticed and commented upon. It led to objections and occasionally violence. It bleeds over into the 1970s, and I imagine we'll talk about it next time as well, but I'll just mention as a kind of lead into that, that in 1971 and 72 on the carriers Kitty Hawk and Constellation, there were what amounted almost to race riots as black sailors protested what they considered the closing off of opportunities within the ranks for sailors of color and the disproportionate impact of captain's mast on sailors of color. So that there was a lot of bleed over between the Vietnam War and the anxiety and protest that triggered and the civil rights movement and the uncertainties and anxieties that created, both at home in the United States and in the Navy itself.
And that's a great way to roll up the 1960s, and I know a lot of these issues we'll be touching on again for the next episode for the 1970s. Again, thank you very much, Craig, and we'll see you next time.
You bet, Sal.
Claude, as we roll into the 1960s and the land of tomorrow and the space race, in the civilian side of the house, we saw a great burst in growth in technology and computers. How did that growth in those two areas translate over to the Navy during the 60s?
Well, as they're reflected in the articles in Naval Institute Proceedings, you do start to see a number of articles about computers and technology and their impact. In September of 1961, for example, Lieutenant Commander John Chastain writes an article on the role of computers in combat control and suggests that the Navy Naval Tactical Data System is just the first step, that computers would have much more important role. And it was a very forward-looking article. You had other articles like the Automated Control of Logistics by Lieutenant Commander Jan Prokop in July of 1967. The lieutenant commander suggested that you had to make sure that the Navy wouldn't suffocate under a mountain of requisitions. you know, something that you might argue still happens today, you know, and said that that was essential, providing that the automated control didn't quickly become obsolete. So you had these things going on. You had folks like Captain Robert Truax, who was writing on missile technology. He was a class of 1939 from the Naval Academy. And Captain Truax was one of the interrogators after World War II of Wernher von Braun. And so from that came our missile development. So this was somebody who clearly understood what was going on. But you had other things developing that weren't quite computers or technology per se. Just as you have in the past decade had an article by Lieutenant Hipple and Lieutenant Cheney Peters on, you know, it was build me a ship or build me a cruiser, about the role of that 3D printers would have on the fleet. In 1963, you had an article by George Saunders, who writes about containers and container ships. Now, today, we look at here on the Chesapeake Bay, ships coming up and down the bay every day toward Baltimore, leaving Baltimore, these great container ships. And we tend to forget that this was a post-World War II development. So this article was the first of many on this entirely new type of merchant ship, the container ship, that revolutionized military logistics. When you think about it, a ship would pull into port for days or weeks at a time, while this old netting system of trying to convey by crane all the articles on board and offload them. But now with containers, it became this giant Tetris system, if you will, you know, referring to the old computer game. So I think there were some significant advances in technology in the 1960s.
Early on in the decade, we saw John F. Kennedy, in a very prescient decision on his part, established special forces organizations such as the Green Berets and, of course, our Navy SEALs, who really came to their own during that decade in Vietnam, both training indigenous forces such as the Montagnards, but also helping to counter guerrilla warfare, and learned a lot of things about their role in modern combat that's still in play today. What can we find at the museum that represents that growth and that experience of our special warfares and guerrilla warfare during the 1960s?
Well, with specific respect to the Warrior Rider exhibit currently on display until the 31st of January of 2016, there are a number of articles that are referenced in this. There was an article in 1962, How to Fight Guerrillas, by Marine Corps Major Doug Stewart, who looked at the characteristics of what guerrilla warfare was. Rear Admiral Robert Powers of the United States Navy, looked at guerrillas and the laws of war and suggested there was a very complex legal status of the guerrilla. You know, were they patriot? Were they terrorist? Were they assassin? Were they soldier? And in some ways, we're still trying to deal with that issue today. You know, are we dealing with somebody who is a patriot one day, and then 10 years down the road, they have turned around and they are now a terrorist working against the United States or one of our allies. So the definition certainly been a contentious issue over the past several decades. In May 1965, you know, we deal with piracy today off Somalia or Southeast Asia, but in May of 65, Captain Burdick Britton, who was a retired naval officer, wrote about a new generation of pirates at sea and what the Navy should understand about them. And in response to this, certainly you referenced the SEALs. One of the first articles that we see in Proceedings in 1965 is The Combat Swimmer by Lieutenant David Watts, Navy Reservist, and that included a pictorial on the men who were moving from UDT status to SEAL status just as the Vietnam War is getting underway. There's also some very interesting takes on guerrillas as well. In April of 1964, it's a really fascinating article by Rear Admiral John Harley, retired admiral. It's titled Patrol Guerrilla Motorboats. And in this, Admiral Harley looks at the world's navy's past and present motor torpedo gunboats and recommended a new design to deal with the current shallow water guerrilla challenges. And I think that's what we need to start seeing again. If you look at the past decade, especially where Navy irregular warfare has really had its ups and downs whether or not it was from funding for an office or being consumed into another office at the Pentagon, you don't see as many responses to how we might address maritime irregular warfare, or in their terms, guerrilla warfare, certainly the kinds of boats that are needed to challenge them.
And during our discussion about the 1950s, we talked about how we started to see articles being written by our former enemies in World War II, mostly Japanese, discussing their experiences. During the 1960s, what do we see with the writing of history?
Well, we have several letters on display framed up on the wall from, say, Spruance to E.B. Potter, Admiral Spruance, Admiral King, Admiral Nimitz, were all writing to E.B. Potter. For any listeners who are Naval Academy graduates of the past, say, quarter of a century, E.B. Potter was on staff for several decades. And the one reason why you want to read Potter's book about sea power in World War II is because he is communicating directly with the fleet admirals. He's getting it directly from them on what happened. So it's very reflective of this. And I think we see that with the next generation of, you know, you have Craig Simons on this series, and Craig is of that ilk of, and that level of understanding about the war because he was communicating with them, as we'll see in the 1980s podcast and see an example of that. So we see that, and as we also see the oral history program at the Naval Institute take off under Dr. John Mason. And this oral history program continues today. It's been going on for 50 years. And what they have tried to do and done very well is capture a lot of these flag and general officers and other individuals as well to have some extensive backgrounds, 8, 10, 20 hours worth of oral histories. So what we have on display is one of the cassettes, one of the reels that was done for an oral history of Admiral Arleigh Burke. And it's interesting to see the students come in and just look at the wall and try to figure out what this round thing is with some tape. They can't figure it out. And so what we try to explain to them is that technology changes very rapidly. For example, Sal, you and I likely grew up in the 70s and 80s when we were accustomed to 8-track cassettes, and that gave way to a smaller cassette tape, and that gave way eventually to other forms, whether it was iPads or listen to music through iPhone. So you have this changing technology, and people tend not to realize where they came from. But these oral histories are extremely valuable in helping us to understand the undercurrents and the strategies and the considerations of these officers during a time of war.
Yeah, I know there's been a lot of discussions by historians and people in general about how we're going to be able to archive all this information with mm-hmm. how technology has changed over and over and over. I know I have an old computer that I keep just to be able to get some stuff I have on RAID drives and floppies. And it's funny you mentioned the 8-track cassette back in high school. I had a 68 Cutlass convertible with an 8-track in it. And still one of the more shocking moments of my life was walking into a record store and asking for the Police latest edition on 8-track. And the girl looked at me, you know, they're not making those anymore. So that was quite distressing. And anybody who had 8-track and enjoyed Pink Floyd can never listen to Dark Side of the Moon without that awkward break that goes through. But we're not having a music podcast, so let's get back to the Navy. But I think that's a good thing to talk about, how even within living memory, we forget how much things have changed. And there's trivial change, like what is the media that you're your music or your recordings are on. But there's also more significant change. And one thing that Craig and I brought into the discussion about the 1960s is the huge upheaval and change, especially after 1964 with the civil rights movement. And it just continued to gain steam and radicalization through the 60s. And we'll probably touch on it again in the 1970s. And with those changes during the 1960s, we also saw a lot of changes in Navy personnel policy. What are some things that the visitor can find out about that particular part of our Navy in the 1960s?
Well, it's interesting because you see it from all ranks addressing these personnel issues. You have in 1960, for example, Fleet Admiral Chester Nimitz writing an open letter to junior officers to have faith in the wisdom of their choice of a career in the Navy. Yet 2 years later, we see in 1962 an article by then-Lieutenant J.G. Jonathan T. Howe called A Time of Decision and asking, why are so many outstanding junior officers leaving the service that we must recognize the issues and fix them? Well, this is an article that you could see in proceedings in 2015 or 1985. So this is, again, one of those timeless issues. Why are junior officers leaving? How can we keep them? And then there were people who tried to respond. You know, the Secretary of the Navy Paul Nitze writes an article on retaining high quality officers and suggesting that was his most serious problem. So it's not a new problem, but you also start to see this this response to that not quite the civil rights movement, but that whole era of the 1960s. You have a midshipman who's from Stanford NROTC, a midshipman Dan Caldwell, who writes about campus unrest in 1969, and in which he's describing his disapproval of student unrest over the war in Vietnam, and just a few other oddly compelling articles like that during this time. So again, we're not seeing anything new, but I think it's. There's a bit of a revelation in that fact alone, that we are continue to address some of the mainstays. And this is something we talked about in the first podcast about what do we see generally in the Naval Institute proceedings articles and the Warrior Writer exhibit. It's the fact that every decade they're writing about strategies, about personnel, about tactics, about operations and technologies. Those remain the mainstays. It's the threats that change, it's the technologies that change, and how these officers are responding to that.
With that, we bring the decade to a close, and I look forward to continuing on with the 1970s.
Great, thank you.